So Kunti Devi, although she's not one of the most prominent personalities of the Mahabharata in terms of her actions and activities during the whole epic, she is still one of the most powerful and the strongest of characters in the Mahabharata. So let me share with you, although I'm sure that you have all heard and you're all familiar with these wonderful pastimes, let me share with you something of the experiences of Kunti Devi. So Kunti was born not as Kunti but as Prita, and she was the second child of King Sura, Maharaj Sura from Surasena. He was the king of Mathura, and he became also the father of Vasudev, or Krishna's father. But when she was very young, he gave his daughter away to another king whose name was Kunti Bhoja. And Kunti Bhoja was his nephew, his cousin. So she remained within the Yadu dynasty, but she became the daughter of Kunti Bhoja, and he named her Kunti after the district in which he was ruling. So she grew up in the Kunti province, which is northeast of Surasena, a little more towards the middle of India and down a little bit. So we all know, perhaps most of us know, how when Kunti was a young girl, her father, Kunti Bhoja, was very fond of personally hosting different sadhus when they would come to his province. And one time Durvasa Muni came there. Now Durvasa Muni is a little bit famous. Durvasa Muni is a partial incarnation of Lord Shiva himself. And Durvasa Muni was very moody and very difficult to serve. He would demand something and then say, take it away. And then he would say, bring this right now. And then he would say, now I'm going to bathe. Make sure this is here when I come back. And he would change his instructions in different ways. And therefore, it was a little bit difficult for somebody who was serving him not to become impatient. But Kunti Devi was endowed with a very, very tolerant nature, very sattvic. And so she managed all the different things that Durvasa Muni did, all his moods and all of his different demands. She tolerated them, although there was plenty of reason to complain. And at the end of his stay, he examined her and he noted her quality. He also could see, because of his excellences, his spiritual ability, he could see the future of this girl. And so he gave her a gift, a benediction. And he told her that I will give you a mantra. And this mantra, if you chant this mantra, you can call any devata that you want, and he will give you a child. So Kunti was only about 13 years old. She was just a young girl. And one day she had this mantra she'd been given, and she didn't really fully understand its import. And so she was sitting in the palace chambers by herself, and she was looking out the window, looking at the sun, and it was shining so brightly. And just in a playful way, she chanted the mantra while looking at the sun. And within an instant, almost within a moment, a brilliantly effulgent personality appeared before her in her room. She was looking at him, and he said, I am Suryadev, and I have come to satisfy your desire. And she didn't understand. She was very innocent. So she said, oh, I just chanted this mantra. I was given this mantra, so I was just trying to see how it worked. So, thank you. And more or less she said to him, thank you, you can go now. And he waited for a moment, and then he said to her, but I am under the power of this mantra. Whatever this mantra you have chanted is meant to bestow, you must accept it. And she was very nervous, and she said, oh, but I'm just a young girl and I live here in the palace. And she could see there was no way that she wanted to accept this boon. So again she refused, and she was quite firm. Thank you, thank you. And then Suryadev said to her very politely that if you do not accept the boon of this mantra, it will automatically pass a curse on the person who chanted it and upon yourself. And then she became quite worried. And so then, reluctantly, she had to accept. So she describes this at the very end of her life, and she says that it was like an effulgence that came upon me, and then I found I had a child. Now, what was she going to do with this baby? It was so beautiful. He had earrings on, and he had armor on even when he was born. And he was effulgent, just like Suryadev himself, who disappeared as soon as the child was there. So she didn't want anyone to know about this. Who would believe her? How would she keep her reputation? What would happen to her? What would happen to the kingdom if it was known in such a strict Vedic civilization that she had had a child outside of marriage? And so the only thing she thought to do was to take the child. She made had a beautiful wooden basket made. She put royal cushions in the basket. And because there was a river that flowed through the province nearby to the palace, she was able to take this basket secretly down to the river, placing the baby in the basket and letting the basket float down the river, praying and praying and praying to Suryadev that you please take care of this, your child. And then she went back to the palace and she didn't tell anyone her secret. So then, sometime later, it was time for Kunti Devi to be married, but nobody came forward to accept her hand in marriage. And so King Kunti Bhoja, he held not exactly a swayambar, but he held a ceremony in which kings could come and she could choose for herself who she wanted to marry. And to that ceremony came Maharaj Pandu, who was the head of the Kuru dynasty, as I said, a little up north from Kunti and even from the Mathura and the Yadu dynasty. Above still was the Kuru dynasty. And the Kuru dynasty's headquarters was in a city called Hastinapur, which was more than just a city as we know it, but a huge area just a little bit below Kurukshetra. And Maharaj Pandu was the ruling monarch of the Kuru dynasty, and he came to this ceremony, and Kunti saw him and she said, I want to marry him. And so the marriage ceremony was arranged and everything went very auspiciously, and she became very happy and he was very happy. She was an ideal wife and queen. And then he took her back to Hastinapur, and there she was settled with him. And he became, you know, when a man, especially a king, gets married, he gets twice as strong. And then he wants to go out and conquer the world. But before he could go out and do that, Bhishma Dev decided that two wives were better than one. Because if one wife should die, everything in a dynasty is about progeny. Everything was centered around the next generation or the succession. Because as soon as the dynasty had no further male heir, then the dynasty basically was finished. And there were different ways that you could deal with this problem, as we hear here with Maharaj Pandu. There were Vedically authoritative ways to deal with the fact that you have no heir to the throne. But generally, this was the concern of every king. So Bhishma Dev arranged for Madri, who came from Madras. She was the princess of the king of Madras, and she was brought to Hastinapur, and she became the second wife. And Kunti was very noble-minded, and so she accepted Madri. Sometimes there was a problem with co-wives. It was a difficult factor, but not in this case. Then Maharaj Pandu, he went out, and he conquered all the different directions. Sometimes Srila Prabhupada refers to the Mahabharata to Greater India, and sometimes he refers to the Mahabharata as referring to the whole world. So this is a little mysterious, and I haven't quite understood how it is the whole world and also India at the same time, except that India in those days was not just the subcontinent as we know it today, but India extended up north and it extended on both sides as well. And the same Vedic Hindu culture extended downwards into Malaysia, even Indonesia, even perhaps into what we now know as Australia, even perhaps to Perth. Who knows? But Maharaj Pandu went around and he conquered all these different provinces and he became a very, very powerful ruler. But then he decided that actually he had done his duty now as a king and he wanted to retire. So he retired at a very young age. He retired at a very young age and he went to the hill stations on the lower area of the Himalaya mountains along with his two queens. And he spent most of his time just hunting and being in the forest. And he was very much enjoying this peaceful lifestyle away from all the quarrels and the struggles of the palace and maintaining all of the different citizens and provinces. Here he was very happy. But in those days, just like we have oftentimes, we have car accidents, road accidents. In those days, it was not uncommon that they had hunting accidents because the kings were in the forest hunting, but the sadhus and sages also lived in the forest. And sometimes those sages lived in very remote places, or they could do things that were a little bit mystical. So as we know, Maharaj Pandu, he shot two deers in the act of mating. And then he heard a scream, a human scream, and he realized that both of those deers were actually yogis, a yogi couple who were mating to form a family in the form of deers. And the male, he cursed him, the sage cursed him. At first he said, "I cannot curse you that you killed a sadhu because I was disguised as a deer, you couldn't tell. But I will curse you because we were in the form of mating to have a family. So if ever you enter into this kind of relationship with your wife, immediately you'll be finished." So Maharaj Pandu told his wives this. And from that day, he decided to become a very, very, very strict yogi. And with his wives who went with him, he went high, high, high up into the Himalaya mountains. And there he practiced severe austerities. He became a real yogi. And he spent all of his time meditating and trying to become very, very focused and strong. But he was also a king. He also had a dynasty. And while he was up there, he resigned as king. In Hastinapur, the Kuru dynasty was now under the care of Dhritarashtra. And Dhritarashtra, being his elder brother who was blind, was simultaneously very sorry that this had happened to his brother, but also quite happy as well, because this meant that he couldn't come back, so he couldn't be the king. So possibly, as he was now holding the position of king in his behalf, he thought to himself, if our family's lineage could continue the kingship, this would be perfect. And meanwhile, Pandu had no sons. But then he came to a point where he was thinking, I should have a son. I should have some family. I should have somebody to send down to become the next king. And, as we know, Kunti's mantra came in very handy at that time. So Kunti used that mantra three times. The first time, at the request of Pandu, because this was a righteous act under the Vedic culture, he decided, I want a son who is so dharmic, he's so righteous, he's so pure, I want a son like that. And so he told her, call Dharmaraj or Yamaraj. And Yamaraj appeared, and that year Yudhisthira was born. Now the following year he thought again, and he said, to maintain a dynasty, you need somebody very, very powerful. Dharma is very good. It is good to be a good person. But without power, you can't actually protect the citizens from unrighteous people. So he said to her, he thought which was the most powerful deva, and he decided that Vayu, or the god of the wind, because the wind just moves everything, destroys everything. So call Vayu. And Vayu was called, and Bhima was born. And then he thought again. And the third time he said, these two qualities should be combined. I want a son who is the most righteous and the most powerful together. So who to call? He said, call Indra. He's the head of all the devas. Call him for the third child. And so Kunti did this. She chanted the mantra and Arjuna was born. Now meanwhile, in Hastinapur, Maharaj Dhritarashtra's wife Gandhari, she was destined, astrologers had said, she would have 100 sons. And that was why she was chosen as the wife of Maharaj Dhritarashtra. This was Vyasadeva's understanding. He understood all of the future and the past and what was taking place. But when she heard that Yudhisthira had been born, and she had been bearing in her womb Dhritarashtra's seed for 2 years already, and nothing had taken place. One day, out of frustration, she hit her womb very hard, and then, thereafter, she gave birth immediately to a big lump of flesh. And she became very worried and said, what to do? And Vyasadeva appeared there, and he said, you pour cold water over this lump of flesh. Of course, it wasn't supposed to happen, but since it had happened, he said, I can help you. You get 100 pots, clay pots, fill them with ghee, and then pour cold water over this lump of flesh. And as she did so, it separated into small, tiny parts, and she, at his instruction, placed one part in each of these pots. And then he said, you wait 2 years. Put them in a room and wait 2 years. And just at the end, she also thought, it would be so nice to have a daughter. 100 sons, at least one daughter. And then, by Vyasadeva's arrangement, there was one small part left, so there was 101 pots. And the first of those sons to appear from that room was Duryodhana, with very, very inauspicious omens. And he appeared exactly on the same day as Bhimasen appeared. The two of them were actually the same age. But Bhima was up in the country and she was in the palace. So then Arjuna was born, and then Madri began to feel quite sad, because she had heard of the 100 sons of Gandhari, and she saw the sons of Kunti, and she had no sons. So she asked Pandu, and he said, I was also thinking that perhaps we can use this mantra to satisfy your desire as well. And Madri thought very cleverly and thought, well, I probably will only get one chance, and the Ashvini Kumars are two. So she prayed, she said, I want the prayer to be for the Ashvini Kumars. And they came, and both of them impregnated her, and she had twins, Nakul and finally Sahadev. So all the boys started to thrive, they grew up, and just imagine, they were born in the company of ascetics in the forest. They weren't born in the city, they weren't born in the royal palace. They had no experience of all the opulences that was life in Hastinapur. And then one fateful day, as we know, Maharaj Pandu fell victim to that curse, and he became attracted to his wife Madri. And because of that attraction, he came towards her, and then when he touched her, he felt a terrible pain in his heart, and he screamed loudly and fell backwards, dead. So Madri started to scream and calling Kunti, Kunti, come, come. And she knew immediately what had happened. And Madri said, leave the children, come quickly. So Kunti came. And when they saw that Pandu had passed away from this world, they both cried and cried and cried. And then they had to make all the arrangements for the funeral ceremony. And the sages who were present there instructed them what to do. But Kunti said, I will enter on to do the sati. I will do the sati. But Madri said, no. If we both do sati, then these boys will have no parent. And if you do sati, then I have to take care of your children. But I'm not a very good mother. And I won't be able to see your sons as the same as my son. But you're so exalted that you can see both sets of boys as the same. So please allow me to do the sati, and you take care of the boys. So with a very heavy heart, they made this arrangement. And Madri entered the fire. And Kunti now was all alone in the forest. How difficult. How difficult. Five little boys. And Bhima was very boisterous. And two of them not even yours. Two of them are now orphans. They don't even have a mother or a father. And you're the sole provider for these boys in the forest. And when Dhritarashtra heard this very, very tragic news, again, he was very sorry, but he was also very glad. Because now fate was arranging that his sons were looking more and more likely to be able to become the future kings. But he did his duty with mixed feelings. And he called for Kunti and the boys that they should now come to Hastinapur, and he would give them all care and protection. So the sages arranged for the boys to come to Hastinapur, and they came with their mother. And imagine what it was like. They were used to seeing like things like you see in our backyard. Trees and grass and green and all sorts of things like that. But they weren't used to seeing domes and and other paraphernalia made by men. But now here they were coming to Hastinapur. And as they entered the city, the citizens noticed immediately that these five boys were extraordinary because they were half deva. They were not ordinary human beings. They had superhuman qualities. And the next person who noticed that these boys were extraordinary was Duryodhan. Duryodhan looked at them and he saw their character, he saw their handsomeness, he saw their prowess, he saw all these things. And instead of feeling honored or proud that he had these boys as his cousin brothers, he became exceedingly angry and envious, because he too had set his mind on his father's plan. And now Kunti and her sons, as a unit, became an object worthy of extermination. What else could you say? They were in the way. They were truly in the way of everyone in the palace's plan. Of course, not everyone. Because Bhishma Dev was there and he took care of them. He loved the Pandavas and he took care of them with the greatest of care. And Dronacharya was there and he was the martial arts guru. And he invited them to study under him naturally and they excelled in different ways. And Vidura was there and he was their uncle as well. And he was always watching over them. Very, very carefully. But while they were on one side, Duryodhan and his brothers and Dhritarashtra, who was ultimately in charge of everything, they were trying to think of some way how to get rid of them. So this was Kunti's life. It's very important to understand what her situation was like, because then you get a depth of understanding of where her feeling was coming from. If I say, oh, such and such is difficult for me, it's difficult for me to carry this bag, it's a little too heavy for me, please if you could help me, it's a little thing. But if I say, this is my difficulty, and I explain something enormous difficulty, unresolvable difficulty, then one has to listen more carefully to the situation that is facing this person. So Kunti Devi and the boys were in Hastinapur. And from an early time, Krishna was aware of them. When he came to Mathura and he killed Kamsa, and then soon after that, he sent a Krura from Mathura to find out how the situation was with the Pandavas and Kunti. And so Akrura came. He came to Hastinapur and he stayed there for some months. And he was also like a family member, distant family member. So he observed everything very carefully because he was on an assignment. And he saw how everything was taking place. He saw how Dhritarashtra was behaving. And he saw the malice of his son. And he spoke to Kunti, and she cried and cried. She was very emotional. And she said, I feel so vulnerable here. Do my family members remember me? Do they care about me? Do they know that I'm in so much difficulty here? They're plotting and planning in different ways to kill us. Even Bhima and Duryodhan, they were bitter rivals. And Duryodhan tried to poison him as little children, as young teenagers, and pushed him into the river to drown. And for 1 week, she didn't know where he was. How would you feel if for 1 week you didn't know where your parents were, or you didn't know where your children were? You had no idea where they had gone. And then he returned, and he told her of the power he had received. So every time Duryodhan did something to torture them, they received more blessings, they received more strength, they received more support than they had before. So I made the subject matter of my class. Let me see if I can find it. What's the name of my class?
Remaining safe
in a difficult situation. Yes. So what I wanted to say is their story continues on. It continues on until eventually they were sent to Varnavarta, to the house of Lak, to be burnt alive. And very cleverly the Pandavas protected themselves. Vidura warned them that there's some plot here. Be very careful. And they checked and they noticed the flammability of all of the structure in which they were living. And then Vidura sent an engineer there whose job it was to dig a tunnel underground right to the bank of the Ganga. And so every day the Pandavas would go out hunting and Virochan would go with them. He was the one who was the caretaker who was supposed to set the house on fire. He would go with them to keep an eye on them. So they would direct him away from the house all day so that the digging could go on. And then in the evening they would come back, and Bhimasen would stay awake every night. And because he was awake, Virochan couldn't light the fire because they were supposed to be asleep and then he could light it. Otherwise they could escape. So this went on actually for a whole year until they received word that the tunnel was ready. And then with great satisfaction, Bhima himself lit the fire. And Virochan was the one who was sleeping when the fire took place. And there was some family in the house with 5 sons. And so the remains, the ashes of the mother and those sons, the remains of their bodies, were considered to have been those of the Pandavas. And the Pandavas escaped underground to the bank of the Ganga. And then, again, here they were in the forest, just like in the beginning of their lives. And they knew the forest well. And Bhima was so strong, he carried the twins and his mother on his back as they were running to escape any risk of being identified. And they stayed like that in the forest. And their forest sojourn remained until they heard about Draupadi Swayambar, and they went together as a group. Actually, they went only as Arjuna went, disguised as a brahmana, to the Swayambar of Maharaj Draupada, whose daughter Draupadi was about to be married. And Arjuna was disguised as a brahmana, because that's how they were hiding, and he was seated there, and the king had arranged a massive bow. And the first part of the competition was you had to string the bow. And all these kings would come forward and they would try to string the bow, but it was very, very difficult. And then gradually, as all of the competition was removed, Karna was the only one who could actually do this. He strung the bow. And then he had an opportunity to shoot up at a target in the sky that was hanging behind a wheel. And you had to hit the fish right in the eye of the fish through the revolving chariot wheel. And Kunti, who was also known as Krishna, she understood. Draupadi, who was named Krishna also, she understood that Karna could actually succeed at this. And so therefore what she did, she stepped forward and she refused him entrance into the competition on the basis of his birth. It was unknown where he had been born or who were his parents. And so then Arjuna, after all the kings had had a chance and no one succeeded, Arjuna as a brahmana, because all the brahmanas would come to get their dakshin, he stepped forward and said, I would like to try. And all the brahmanas cheered and glorified him and praised him, because it was rare that a brahmana would do this. And he came forward and he very, very effortlessly, he strung that bow. And then he held it up. And as far as I remember, you had to look down in the water. You had to look in the water, aim, shoot through the moving spokes of the wheel and hit the eye. And Arjuna succeeded. And all the kings became furious. What is this? He's a brahmana. This is not proper. And they became very angry. And Arjuna and Draupadi, they started to leave. But the kings, then they went to attack Maharaja Drupada, because they said, what have you done? You've brought us all here and embarrassed us like this. You've created this situation for us. So they started to come towards Draupadi's father. And so at that time, Yudhisthira and Bhima had arrived, and they came, and together they fought back and they repelled the kings and they left. Now Krishna was there at that ceremony, but he didn't take part in it because he knew that Draupadi was not to be his queen. But he watched these brahmanas and he concluded that these were not ordinary brahmanas. And then with Balaram he went to see them and he offered them support. He said, I will offer you all my military support and everything else. So now you should go back to Hastinapur without backing. Now you are no longer vulnerable, refugees, but we will be with you. And Maharaj Draupada, as we all know, when he heard that his daughter Draupadi was to marry 5 kings, he was very unsure about this arrangement. And he sent a message, because Dhrishtadyumna, her brother, came to follow them. Who are these brahmanas that have taken? And he heard Kunti Devi when she said, she should be shared amongst you. This gift should be shared amongst you. And he looked in the window of the place they were staying, and he saw Kunti Devi was sleeping at their head. There were 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Kunti was sleeping at their head, and Draupadi was sleeping at their feet. And he went back and he told Maharaj Draupada what he had seen. And Maharaj Draupada came there and he invited them, please come to the palace. And they came for the wedding ceremony. And at first he said, this is not possible. But then they explained how, and Vyasadev came. And Vyasadev said, yes, this is actually ordained. And so they had 5 wedding ceremonies, one after another. And it was arranged that Draupadi would be with 1 brother for 1 season. I've forgotten how long that was. And no other brother could come in when that brother was acting as Draupadi's husband. And if they did, they would be exiled to the forest for 1 year. And so everything was arranged. And Maharaj Draupada also said, I will support you. And so with these two, the support of Krishna and Maharaj Draupada, Kunti Devi and the Pandavas were about to return to Hastinapur with strength and with allies. Now I'm going to stop there, but I want to say one more thing, and that is how to find strength in a difficult situation. The answer is that you have to find the other side of the problem. In any difficult situation, there will also be some kind of a blessing. There will also be some kind of a good fortune. If you can find the good fortune within a difficult situation, then you'll be able to maintain yourself through whatever difficulties are present in your life. And this is one aspect of the example that Kunti Devi shows for us. So our time is now finished.
Well, you have to work 5 minutes.
5 minutes.
So you started at a quarter of, and now it's 11:30. So if you could, if we were 15 minutes behind.
Is it possible to open up that? Because it's a little hot in here now.
Yeah, it still has some precipitation coming down. So if we do open that, there will be some.
That's what you were saying. With every curse, there's a blessing. Every blessing is a curse. I vote for the blessing.
If we're going to open it, we just need it.
Can you zip it some partially? Okay. And meanwhile, there was something else that I wanted to say. Oh, that's much better. Yes, thank you. When I was reading the Mahabharata, at first I was very enthralled by the stories. I wouldn't say stories, I would say leelas. Because Srila Prabhupada objected when people called the Mahabharata an epic or stories, in the sense that it was mythology or simply non-spiritual, cultural, moral stories. Stories that will strengthen the fiber or the culture of the people of India. Yet, for centuries, for thousands of years, the Mahabharata was an oral tradition. And it did strengthen the moral fiber of the Indian culture. It made the people of India very knowledgeable because Vyas had mixed within those stories, he had mixed some very powerful philosophical principles. So that it's like with your children when you say, please take this medicine and you mix it with honey. So they take the honey, but they also take the medicine. So within the Mahabharata, of course, we all know, is the Bhagavad Gita, which is the most powerful. Practically speaking, it's the most well-known and powerful book all over India. All the different sects and different lineages in India, they all accept the Bhagavad Gita. Yet, as I studied further, I began to see that there was very often an emphasis on dharma, artha, karma, and finally moksha. And that the final goal that is recommended for the individual who is reading Mahabharata is actually heaven. In the end, at the end of the Mahabharata, everybody meets again in heaven. So the concept that was being given to the people in general was that you do your dharmas, you do your dutiful activities, and then you become wealthy. Because you've done good activities, you become wealthy. And after you become wealthy, then you can satisfy all your desires. And then when you've done your duties, you've become wealthy, you've satisfied all your desires, then at the right time you can leave this world. And after you leave this world, you'll meet all your family members in heaven. And in heaven you will enjoy forever. And as I was reading this, I became a little disheartened because I was thinking, this is not the philosophy that Srila Prabhupada has given us. So I thought to myself, this is actually something that has to be unlearnt from the psyche of those who have grown up with the Mahabharata if they actually want to understand what is the real goal of life. This is like a kind of a halfway mark, And if you only get to there, you haven't actually achieved very much at all. You've become pious, you go up to the heavenly planets, but it isn't eternal, and eventually you'll come down again and you'll do it again and you'll remain within a cycle, going up and down, up and down. And Srila Prabhupada has, amazingly enough, practically speaking, you could count on your fingers the people, other than those who have been trained by our Gaudiya line, you can count on your fingers the people who have the proper understanding of what is the real goal of life, which is to transcend this whole thing, to transcend even the moksha and the happiness of heaven in favor of actually release from this bodily identification and actually coming to the point of understanding my eternal position as a servant. So, I momentarily, from my reading, I became a little disillusioned with the Mahabharata. And I was last night thinking, I'm not quite sure how to proceed, because I myself am not convinced that this is the right teachings to share. Go to heaven, be with all your family again, life is happiness in heaven. And then I was looking for some counsel where I could get some inspiration how to break through this pattern. And I found, when I was reading, I found a quote which I would like to share with you. There's a long-standing school of argument in the spiritual circles of India against the idea that there's the Vedas and the Upanishads and the Jnana Shastras, and then there's the Puranas and the Mahabharata, and these things aren't completely eternal. These are nice stories, but this is the eternal, and that the highest thing is Brahman. And that these Puranas and everything, the bhakti, this is for ladies and sentimental people and so forth. But it actually isn't the pinnacle of spiritual understanding. So one time when Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati was arguing in favor of the importance of the Mahabharata and the Srimad Bhagavatam, he quoted a quote from Srila Bhakti Vinod Thakur. He said that the Mahabharata and the Bhagavad Gita are on the same quality as the Srimad Bhagavatam, and thus they are never to be disrespected. He said there are particular passages in the Mahabharata which might be bewildering to asuras or karmis or jnanis or false devotee, but not to sufficiently qualified devotees. And those Vedic mantras that do not apparently describe Vishnu, in fact, do so exclusively. Yet unless they are understood through pure spiritual guidance, they will undoubtedly be misunderstood. So to put that into simpler language, when you read the Mahabharata, you will read the glorification of all the devatas, you will read of the wonders of going to heaven, you will hear so many lesser injunctions, but if one has the training of understanding Krishna to be the Supreme Personality, one will be able to see deeply that behind everything, behind the mysteries of the Mahabharata, lies the glorification of the Supreme Personality of Godhead and his process of bhakti, unalloyed service to Krishna here and always. So Queen Kunti Devi is about to give us this understanding. Thank you.